Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to the LSE for this evening's event on the opening night of LSE's festival, the LSE Festival on Power and Politics, which is taking place all this week until Saturday, exploring how power and politics shape our world. It is indeed a year of elections. There are such a remarkable number of elections going on at once. And, you know, having myself spent part of last night watching the European election results, before that watching Mr. Modi's inauguration in Delhi, shows you what kind of evenings I spend, doesn't it? And then just, you know, before the end of the evening, there's going to be an election in France. So, and there was one in Belgium as well. So it's hard to exaggerate how much democracy is going on in how many countries this year, and that's just a small cross-section of it, South Africa before that. Anyway, so I'm pleased to be here with our excellent panel, which is both, obviously, they're here, you're here, but there is an online presence. Hello, everybody online. What I want to do first is to introduce the panel, and then after that, I'll say a little bit more before we get going for the evening. So, Nick Anstead is Associate Professor in the Department of Media and Communications, an expert on politics and communication, particularly in British politics, but is keeping a close eye on the upcoming UK election. Is an expert, I can say this, he teaches excellently on my third-year course on social media and presidentialisation and all these sort of marvellous things that are influencing politics today. Mukulika Banerjee is Associate Professor in Social Anthropology at LSE, author of Cultivating Democracy. She's just returned from a trip to India, earlier mentioned, where the largest election in the world has just taken place. And with it, for me, people like me who are pluralists and like these things, an unexpected result. So a result that wasn't exactly what had been predicted. Not so good for pollsters, but interesting for democracy. Sarah Holbolt is Sutherland Chair in European Institutions and Professor in the Department of Government at the LSE, Chair of the European Election Studies and EU-wide project studying voters, parties and candidates in, and the media, bringing it all together, in European parliamentary elections, which have just taken place. Bill Neely is a renowned journalist, former Chief Global Correspondent for NBC News and with a 40-year career in broadcasting. He's just returned from South Africa with insights from the electorate about their most consequential election for 30 years. And there again, as in India, a sort of democratic change, a change point, which is most interesting for those of us who are interested in such things. Now, what we're going to do today is explore issues not only raised by four major sets of elections, which are sort of generally represented on the stage, but each of our speakers, in addition to addressing one of these elections, will also sort of speak more generally on the issues raised not just for South Africa or India or Europe or the UK, but also more generally for democratic elections and what some broader trends around the world, because there are some broad trends that are not unique to any one country or to any one bloc. For those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Festival. I suspect that's the hashtag all week if you're coming back. I would ask you, please, to put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. The event is being recorded and will hopefully, I always love the way it says hopefully as if somehow it's all very risky, hopefully be made available as a podcast subject to no technical difficulties. So what we're going to have is 7 or 8 minutes from each of the speakers about their broad areas of expertise before we have a brief discussion here, but there'll be plenty of time for all of you to get involved as well. Questions both from the audience and for anybody watching, or for all those watching online. So, do enjoy this evening. So the order we're going in, I'll just have to double check this, is Bill. I think this is a set order, Bill. Over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me, and congratulations for the timing of this event after last night's French bombshell. Wow. I am the only journalist here, and journalists like to give snapshots, broad pictures. So I'd like to give you a snapshot of a few of the places that I've been recently. I spent 2 weeks in South Africa watching their election. I've been to America 3 times in the last few months, East Coast and West Coast, although, of course, as we know, the coastal areas aren't really America at all. And I spent 3 weeks in India, and I've just come back from Ireland. So just a few snapshots about a few of those places. And obviously, I can talk in detail about America and probably the biggest election or most important election of the year in November later on. I won't go into great detail. Let's start with South Africa. I should have known this, but I didn't. South Africa is the world's most unequal society, according to the World Bank. I thought it was India, but it's South Africa. It's got the richest square mile in the world in Cape Town. But I went to Nelson Mandela's hometown, Kunu, and I saw a level of poverty there that I had rarely seen in Africa. I saw women scooping water from a puddle in the ground, which was urinated in by monkeys and dogs, and that's what they used once they boiled it up to drink. They had literally no facilities, no power, no water, nothing. And yet they were going to continue to vote ANC because of tribal loyalty, which is interesting, but it wasn't the whole story, because actually South Africa is both a success story in that it's still holding elections after 30 years, and not a success story because there is, in many places, people have political freedom, of course, but they've never achieved economic freedom. There is a lack of jobs. There is an unemployment rate of 42% generally, and among young people, it's somewhere between 50 and 60%. Extraordinary. Crime is sadly still an issue. We went to townships and we actually had to have protection to go into those townships to ask people questions, which is very sad. There is an acute shortage of housing, not just in townships but elsewhere. And in townships, again, no basic services still. People living in what one woman described as a hole in the ground. There are no toilets, there is no running water. People literally do not have power. So what happened in the election? Well, there was a burning desire for change, and the ANC were spanked. And their share of the vote fell to about 40%, which is actually a kind of revolution, because before they had unfettered power for the last 30 years. So 40% in any other country would be good, not in South Africa. And I think the ANC has been sent a message. We will see if they reply to that message. To the United States, as I said, I went to East Coast and West Coast. But remember, the coasts and the cities don't really represent America. Hillary Clinton won most of the 25 big urban centers, 16 out of 17, in fact. And of course, famously, she lost. And once again, the election, I think, will come down to a few 100,000 votes in 6 states. I've covered 5 elections. The states vary. Sometimes it's Florida, sometimes it's Ohio. This time it's 3 Midwestern states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and 3 states with changing demographics, Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia. And Donald Trump is ahead in 5 out of those 6. I talked a couple of days ago to a Pulitzer Prize-winning author whose husband is a pollster. They are experts in Pennsylvania, and they both told me, at the minute, there is no way Joe Biden is going to win Pennsylvania. He has to win Pennsylvania. And there, we know it's a deeply, deeply divided country. The economy is quite good. Unemployment is at an all-time low. Wages are up. But interest rates are high, and people are complaining about a lack of jobs and the lack of ability to buy things like a house. So you will hear probably, as we all speak, these common themes in so many countries: cost of living, inflation, jobs, houses, and of course immigration, which is an issue in the United States. I won't go into any great detail about what happens if Trump wins or what happens if he loses, but open to questions later on. The European elections and my experience of Ireland. I am Irish, and I came back from a country that is quite at ease with itself, where the economy is quite good, certainly better than it is in Britain. But again, the same sort of issues. A lack of housing, the cost of living, immigration. Ireland has taken in more Ukrainians per head of population than just about any country in Europe outside Poland, but migration is an issue, and healthcare. It looks like, as a result of the local and European elections, that the centre is holding in Ireland, and I think that appears to be the case in Europe in general. I think in Europe, you can look at these election results in two ways. Is the glass half full or is the glass half empty? The European People's Party clearly are still going to be the strongest party in the European Parliament, so you could say the centre did hold. But look at what's happening in Germany. Look at the AfD. Many people would see it as a frightening party, which wants to deport migrants, which wants Germany out of the European Union, which the German intelligence service calls an extremist organisation. And look at France. Marine Le Pen's party is now extremely strong. It just got double the number of votes of Macron's party. So is the glass half full? Yes, the centre did hold. Or is it half empty? The right is coming. Difficult to say, and let's debate that later on. But I think you can see the same themes across many, many of these elections. Mukhalika can speak about India. India, to me, was, and I spent time there, a great democratic triumph. Modi was humbled in a way, but I think the real test will be, will Modi compromise, or will he in fact just crack down even more? He has to have a coalition government, but will that hamper his authoritarian instincts, or will he continue to go after judges and journalists and opposition figures? So, you know, in many ways, these elections, this election year, is about the same old things. As Bill Clinton's people said in 1992, it's the economy, stupid. So plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. And yet, voters are more anxious, I think, this year about the world than they've ever been before. And one thing strikes me, climate change just hasn't been a major issue anywhere. I'm not saying that's right or that's wrong, but it is, to me, extraordinary. So I think same old themes apply. It's kick the bums out, make sure the establishment gets a slap on the wrists. And of course, we're now looking forward to July the 4th in Britain, where I think, well, watch out for a massacre.
Thank you, Bill. So the same but different. Interesting, the same but different. OK, Mukhalika, let's go straight on to you.
Okay, so this week, on the 4th of June, the results of the Indian elections were out, so it's hot off the press. We're still digesting the results, looking at the data and so on. But for those of you who missed this and were sleeping under a rock, the dominant party of Prime Minister Modi, if you haven't heard the name Modi, you're definitely still asleep, because he's made sure every person has heard his name. They were expected by their own boast to cross 400 seats in a parliament of 543 seats. The exit poll said that, and you mentioned the pollsters, and I'll come back to that. Instead, they won 240. So 272 is the majority mark, so they didn't have enough seats to form a government on their own, so they've had to rely on allies to have the seats to form the government. This is the result as it stands. What does it tell us? And I really want to persuade you to think about India not as an afterthought to the Euro-American world, as often is the case in the international press, but to really think this is a sixth of the world's population living in the world's largest democracy. What happens in India is consequential for India, of course, but I think for the state of democracy anywhere in the world. Whether or not you agree, Mr. Modi has told the world that India is the Vishwaguru, the world leader, the teacher to the world of how things work. So if it is indeed a Vishwaguru, then what has India taught us about democracy? And I think it, for all of us going to vote on the 4th of July in this country, and I really, how many students here vote? How many of you have the vote? Well, okay, some have the vote and are not going to vote. That's an, I hope it'll come up in discussions. Young people need to vote is my one line. I have to get that in. What does it tell us about, you know, what does it teach us about how to vote in the British election, in the US election, in the European elections, French elections, etc.? There's some takeaways that I want you to think about, please. First thing is, don't believe the pollsters, or if you do, make sure you've checked their methodology. I know this sounds really nerdy. Tony said how he's told you how he spends his evenings. That's what those of us who study elections, that's our life. We're a bit nerdy about these things. But watch for the methodology, how they are sampling, what they're doing, because in India, the scam really was the polling, and the international press just picked it up and repeated it verbatim without checking. And they all said BJP is going to cross 400. And now the data is coming out. We're looking at it. It was a stock market scam, which a lot of foreign investors have made a lot of money on the back of that exit poll, which is a whole different story. We can talk about it if anyone's interested. Now, what were the conditions in which the Indian elections were held in April and May? This was the longest election India's ever had, over seven phases. There was the conditions, the state of democratic institutions in India were at their lowest. We talk about backsliding. This is as low as it's been, where if you look at the classic markers of a democracy, separation of powers, you'd expect the judiciary to do its job. It wasn't doing it, to put it mildly. The opposition leaders had been jailed. The free media, which is the fifth pillar of democracy, we talk about it, fourth pillar of democracy, is the mainstream media is completely compliant and does at the government's bidding and amplifies the government's message, like the exit poll of 400 plus. Campaign finance, an issue that we should be worried about in Britain. I don't know how many of you realize, but the Tories have put up the limit of campaign spending rather unilaterally. Campaign finance was made completely opaque in India a few years ago, with a law pushed through Parliament that wasn't allowed to function, and so on. So, and worst of all, the one thing that India did very well and why Indian elections were always taken seriously was because despite its disadvantages, India always conducted magnificent elections, given the scale of the exercise. We're talking about 970 million voters. I mean, that's most of all the countries we studied put in times three. So this is a large-scale exercise. The Election Commission of India actually did use to do its job. This time, it didn't. And one marker of that was that there is a convention of the Modern Code of Conduct that kicks in, which monitors public utterances by politicians and hate speech. And there was a lot of hate speech from Mr. Modi, deliberate targeting of minorities, deliberate polarization of the electorate, name-calling and so on, misrepresentation of the opposition's manifesto, and he wasn't censured once. So the overall picture conclusion is that this is the most unfair election that India has ever held in its 75-year history of nearly 75 years of holding elections. So what does the voter do in this kind of scenario? How do you deal with a democratic structure that is so hollowed out? How do you respond to this when an election comes along? And we've seen the verdict where clearly some of the prize messages of the BJP government, for instance, many of you may have seen this on television here, the temple built to Lord Ram in Ayodhya. This was going to be the big message of this election. I've delivered the Ram temple to you. Now, I was traveling around in India for 5 weeks in April, May, and a person who votes for the BJP, is an admirer of the BJP, votes for Mr. Modi. When I said to him, he said, you know, this time it's a bit, there's no wave, really. There's no big issue. And I said, why isn't the Ram Temple a big issue? And he said, oh, the Ram Temple, Mr. Modi's built the temple for himself, not for us. What has that got to do with me? And BJP lost Ayodhya's seat. So this was, you know, this was a message that was being sent through the election, through the vote. Now, in India, unlike a lot of Euro-American democracies, Indians actually like to vote. Turnouts are high and rise with every election. So people, and I've spent a lot of years writing, researching and writing. I have a book called Why India Votes. Really, I wanted to call it Why the Hell Do Indians Vote, given they get, but my publishers wouldn't allow that because they get so little out of it. You think it's a transactional thing. But people like the act of voting because it is an assertion of citizenship. It is what my political science colleagues called the expressive aspects of voting. But it's really, if you are in a socially disadvantaged position, and remember 800 million out of 1.4 billion people have to live on food rations in order to survive. This is survival. India's rank on the hunger index has really deteriorated in the last 10 years. So if you belong to that 800 million people, this is your chance to be counted as genuinely politically equal to the next person. It's the only place where people like us in this room, if you were in India, you would have somebody to drive your car or mop your floors. That's the way Indian middle-class life is structured. That is the only day you arrive at the polling booth and you see your maidservant in the front of you in the queue and you can't say, go to the back, give me your place. You know, of course, sense of entitlement. You can't do it. And that's why if you are the maidservant, and most of Indians belong to that socioeconomic category, and it's giving South Africa a run for its money on social inequality. Sadly, 1% of India owns 40% of the wealth. I mean, it's really quite stark. The figures get worse and worse. People like to vote because they get taken seriously that day. But in this election, this most unfair election, all these odds were stacked against them. So how did they deliver a verdict that has gladdened so many hearts of people? Not necessarily if you're partisan, pro-Modi or anti-Modi, that's not the question. It's whether democracy and democratic culture can survive, right? Can you build, can you have a real opposition? This has been the plaintive plea of people who wanted to a different kind of politics. And you can't understand this verdict. You can't understand democracy in operation during an election unless you see what happens in between elections. That's when the democratic culture of the country that elections are meant to deliver is in operation. And this election came post-COVID, which was horribly mismanaged in so many ways by the central government, Mr. Modi's government. Migrant workers were thrown out on the highways to walk home because they were given 4 hours' notice before a lockdown. 4 hours. Remember how things were managed here? Wherever you were, I'm sure it was better. This was the first election where the real impact of this new national One Nation, One Tax, the GST that was brought in, was really felt. And this is what my colleague Pavitra Suryanarayan and from the government department and I are working on at the moment, and more about that if you want to hear it. The very unconstitutional Citizenship Amendment Act that the Shaheen Bagh protest by a bunch of elderly Muslim women and many, many supporters saw just before the pandemic, and the very, very unfair farmers' laws that were agricultural laws that were brought in that saw huge farmers' protests for over 12 months in a blockade of the national capital. These were things that were happening in the democratic culture. People took the places they could do it when they could associate in numbers, create solidarities. We talk about power in politics, and I say this, power is really when people come together. It's not held by any one person. It is in us to come together. And we saw this kind of organization and protest in those inter-election years. So when 2024 came, all of rural India seems to have voted against the BJP. Surprise, surprise. You shouldn't be surprised if you'd see what happened. I bet a lot of those migrant workers were not voting for the central government that threw them out on the highways, and so on. So if we had to sort of draw back from the nitty-gritty of the Indian case and what happened in 2024, clearly there is something to be said about living in an age of misinformation and how news is disseminated, the televisions blare every night with fake news and hysteria, and to be able to literally cut through the noise requires it, in order to stay sane and keep sight of what you want to think, you need to educate yourself, you need to inform yourself, and you need to organize with other people who agree with you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mukulika. And actually, from these first both two presentations, both downbeat, but upbeat in the sense that in both South Africa and in India, despite everything, the democracy still is functional. It can still put up a fight. People still have that freedom to vote against whatever the controls are. So that's an interesting lesson from both countries, it seems to me. Sarah, Europe, Belgium, France.
Well, let's start with France, because as we already was already mentioned, of course, even yesterday, sort of 24 hours ago, we didn't quite know that we were going to have an extra election to talk about, which for those of us in this panel is always exciting. The more elections, the better. Any French citizens in the room?
Ooh,
so are you equally excited to be going to the polls in 3 weeks? Well, of course, the decision of French President Macron to hold these snap elections, even more snap, perhaps he looked at Sunak and thought, that looks like it's a pretty successful strategy. I'm going to do that. Well, of course, came on the back of predicted victory of Le Pen's national rally in the European Parliament election, where, as was already mentioned, topped the polls and doubled the votes of the alliance of Macron. And so, in sort of typical French presidential style, he then made an address to the compatriot, the people of France, some of you will have heard it, which is saying, now this heavy, serious decision is now back over to the people. And he puts the trust in the people of France. And I guess he's hoping to make the right decision and not do the same thing again. But what's interesting about that way he frames this choice, and it was also something that was very much framed on the night of the European election results coming in last night, was it was sort of a different sort of division in Europe. He was saying, on the one hand, well, didn't say as much, but what he's going to want to frame it is that on the one hand, we have these centrist, pro-European, pro-democratic, sensible forces, mainstream forces in politics. And on the other hand, we have this threat of the far right. And now it is over to you, the people of France, to choose. And it struck me also when the leaders of the big centrist groups came back after the results came in last night. The Greens, the Liberals, the Social Democrats, and the Christian Democrats, they all said, now it's time, we, the center, as Bill was, the center, we still have a majority, just about. And now it's about the center to come together. And they said, the pro-European, pro-democracy center. And the implication was against the far right. And I thought it was just very telling that there was this very new, starkly framed division, certainly in European politics, between these two forces. And so that sort of made me think, does that mean that we are seeing this kind of new seismic change in European politics, where there's this new dividing line between, on the one hand, what they would see as the pro-European, pro-democracy, mainstream political forces versus the far right, as they were portrayed last night. If we look at the results, of course, the center did hold and the center did win. There weren't massive shifts on the surface of it. We still have the biggest group being the centrist, center-right European People's Party, after that the Socialists, the Social Democrats, and after that, so far, the Liberals. So that looks very similar on the surface. On the other hand, we of course also saw this shift towards the right, and in particular in certain countries a quite radical shift. In a sense, we talked about France already, but also the AfD in Germany, a very radical hard right party that got 16% of the vote, despite having been so radical that even Le Pen had to kick them out of her group in the European Parliament, because amongst other things, their lead candidate said complimentary things about the SS, and I think that was even too much for Madame Le Pen. So there is a normalization in that sense of the far right, even in countries that that haven't, particularly Germany, of course, has been very, very, in the post-war period, been very careful about containing those sort of forces in politics. And I think we need to also look at the sort of more long-term trends to understand whether this is a big shift or whether it's just more of the same. And I think if we look at it long-term, what we're seeing in Europe, certainly Western Europe, is that we've had in the post-war period really kind of three big political groupings that held power. It sort of changed who had the power, and that was mainly the sort of center-right, the center-left, and the liberals. And that is certainly at the European level, that was the sort of coalition between those. And they agreed on a lot of things, sort of welfare state, capitalist, pro-liberal democracy, pro-European integration broadly. And of course, then there was also a key dividing line. The key contestation was often about how much should the state redistribute, how much should the state intervene in the market, and there would be sort of that would be the kind of classic economic left-right that was in most European countries, Western Europe, the key dividing line. And that's not really the choice that a President Macron or these leaders are now posing. They're not saying, oh, this is the main dividing line. They're saying, no, we have this new division in European politics. And so underlying that is also that voters are not the way voters have been in Europe for these past. There's been a slow shift. In addition to the decline of the center, in particular in the center left, there's also been a weakening of attachment to these big political blocks, the center left, the center right. So an increased volatility where voters, in particular young voters, like many young voters here in this room, are more up for grabs. It's not necessarily a bad thing that you're not sort of blindly attached or loyal to one group, but it does mean that you can see much more volatility in politics. And alongside that, what we're also seeing then is that perhaps that main dimension in politics in Europe is shifting towards something that has much more to do with identity politics, not sort of how do we organize our welfare state, how do we organize economics, but who are we as a nation, who are we as a continent? And the big, again, going back to Macron, he is someone who says, well, I'm going to advocate for a modern progressive outlook that favors and sees the benefits in globalization, in multiculturalism, in diversity, in the liberal international order, in European integration, and that is going to be and has been his pitch. And that's the sort of broad pitch of these centrist mainstream forces. But it's a very different pitch you're going to get from a Madame Le Pen or generally from the far right, from sort of backlash against globalization and what it has brought, multiculturalism, what it has brought, which is, of course, why immigration is often the key or opposition to immigration and everything it's brought, the key policy that unites the far right across Europe. So it's going to be interesting to see, I think, both whether the center holds, you know, is that a sort of permanent shift or is just a marker of our time? Or is this something that means that we're actually seeing a kind of realignment across Europe on a sort of different dimension and also one where might just look like a small change last night in the European Parliament election, but it marks really a kind of crumbling of these big centrist forces that have dominated European politics in the post-war era. So I'll end with a question.
Very good. I mean, but even described as the, as it were, the moderate centrists and or centre-right and these new much more extreme right blocks or groups in different countries, it sounds like a bad story for the left brought together, because the left isn't any part of that, is it? I mean, I'm not particularly for now, but is that right? Have I got that right?
Well, the left is the part of the mainstream parties that have suffered the most. Okay. They're still, I mean, I wouldn't. Okay. They're not radical. They're still in very much okay. In the centre.
All right.
And part of the sort of policy-making coalitions.
Okay, great. Nick.
First of all, I just want to say a huge thank you for the invitation to talk today. The LSE Festival is a brilliant event, and this, you know, panel could not be more topical. When I was invited, I was kind of given the title of the talk, and I was sort of said you could talk about anything, and I was like, okay, that's a tricky one, because obviously it's a topic that's very broad and you could tackle it in lots of ways. But one thing that strikes me about this year of elections, which we've all spoken about so much and thought about so much, is there doesn't seem to be a particular sense of celebration. This isn't a sort of jamboree of democracy celebrating the various different forms. I mean, maybe we find this in some spaces, but that's certainly not the dominant discourse that's existing out there. And that struck me as interesting. So the question I wanted to ask then, but what is the root cause of this sense of crisis? And I want to suggest to you that one common answer, I think, is a little bit misguided. I want to suggest to you some alternative reasons, and I want to bring it back to a bigger question. So the answer I don't find terribly convincing, which, by the way, is deeply hypocritical, because I've just had an LSE explainer video published about social media and misinformation. But the answer I don't find terribly convincing is when people start to frame this around the advent of social media, right? And this is a very seductive explanation, and there are reasons why it seems like a good explanation to us. So we might think, for example, that online spaces provide a breeding ground for populism or polarisation, or they're spaces where you find violent political language, or indeed even the organisational spaces for real world political violence. And of course, some of these things are certainly true, and we only need, I guess, to look at the sort of recent history of American politics, and particularly the events around the presidency of Donald Trump, to see how particularly his use of Twitter infamously was linked to driving some of these tendencies. So I don't want to argue that social media isn't changing politics, but what I want to argue is if we focus on it too much, or we focus on it exclusively, we're missing lots of big story. And in fact, actually, I'd go as far as to say, in some ways, it almost provides too comforting an explanation, right? If we're blaming fake news, if we're blaming misinformation, that's obviously a particularly attractive explanation if we can link it to outside actors. So it's, you know, Russian adverts and such like that is to blame for the various political ruptures that have taken place in recent years. There's a couple of reasons why I don't find the explanation about social media entirely convincing. The first of this is that I've actually been writing about this topic for long enough that I remember when people offered exactly the opposite account of social media. When I started my career in the immediate aftermath of the Obama-McCain election, particularly, in fact, the Obama-Clinton primary election, people were hugely excited about the potential of social media to reinvigorate democracy, to re-engage young people, these young people we're so concerned about, that social media was going to be the way they were going to engage, they were going to learn. So what I want to argue to you that is actually in common with lots of forms of media, actually social media is it's sort of a simulacrum, right? It reflects the conditions of democracy and our fears and our hopes about it at a particular moment in time, and we project that onto the media as our explanation for understanding it. The second point I want to make is that social media can only ever really be a partial answer for a perception, at least, of a democratic malaise. And in fact, if we make it the primary factor, I think we are missing lots of the other things that are going on. So I would reframe the question. So instead of saying something like, what role does Facebook play in the sharing of fake news, I would ask the question in these terms. I would say, why are some citizens actually attracted to misinformation they might encounter on their social media streams? How does this speak to them politically, and why do they find it powerful and engaging? And I think once we start to go beyond this, it opens up a whole host of other questions and wider challenges that democracies face. A non-exhaustive list might include how do you build relatively stable democracies in ages of low or no economic growth? How do democracies cope with inequality? And can that be tackled through democratic means? Can politics deal with longer-term challenges? So climate change being a really obvious one that's often excluded. Ageing population, as the population structure of countries is changing. And how well-equipped are our institutions to cope with the return of geopolitics? So there are connections here, right? So I mentioned the things like misinformation campaigns run by international actors, and clearly that fits in with this return of geopolitics. But more broadly, how does politics cope with an age that appears to be much more unstable? I guess if I were to frame this in one big question, it would be, what does democratic politics actually look like at the end of history? And one thing that strikes me about the British election that's ongoing is actually, I don't necessarily think our political class are coping terribly well with that question, and indeed, nor are they equipped to. So I want to take us out of talking about social media. Instead, I want to talk about communication. I come from the Department of Media and Communication. Generally, my view is we should talk about media a bit less and we should talk about communication a bit more. So the point I would make, and I would use the British election as a case study of this, is it seems unclear to me whether contemporary politicians have at their disposal the rhetoric or the register to articulate the particular types of challenges that modern democracies face. And it's interesting, I guess I was trying to think, what do the archetype contemporary politicians look like? And I came up with two, really. And quite often they're pitched against each other, and one is the technocrat and one is the populist. And it seems unlikely to me that either of these types of actors are capable of articulating the sorts of answers to the questions that I've just posed. It's interesting, actually, just reflecting on what Sarah said about whether there is an attempt to construct a different sort of archetype there, which is the sort of, I guess, a kind of modern version of the Cold War liberal, but a sort of a democratic warrior. And I'm not suggesting that will be successful. Actually, I think the evidence is it probably isn't successful when you try and construct coalitions around that. But maybe it's an attempt to respond to that particular challenge. But what I would conclude by arguing to you is I think it's this communication challenge that seems to me absolutely core to building stable democratic institutions in the future. And it's one reason why I was left quite disheartened watching the television debates. Because really what you saw was two people struggling to say as little as possible.
Okay, very good. And in a rather aggressive way as well, just to make it ideal. Okay, look, four really intriguing presentations which look both at one set of elections, and then tease out some general questions. There's a lot of reaction against things in these elections, it seems to me. And let's bring in the US election, though it hasn't even, well, it has started, of course, we're in the middle of it all the time. So there's a lot of reaction almost everywhere against immigration. I mean, many elections, reactions against immigration and or politicians playing religion. So these are they're not the same thing, but they can have, they overlap. There is a Venn diagram overlap. We've also got, at least in two of the major democracies where elections have already taken place, sort of failed dominant leaderships, either party or individuals, and the electorate coming for them, beginning to, you know, vote accordingly. Now, you might argue that France and the UK might be in that position to some degree as well, but too early to judge, depends what happens in both of those countries. So, there's a cliche, isn't there, certainly in UK politics, that
oppositions don't win elections, government lose them. And yet, some of these issues look like freestanding challenges to governments, particularly democratic governments, where particularly with immigration, it's appearing in lots of countries, religion in some countries, sometimes related, in a way that politicians just don't know what to do about it. They can't stop it, and they don't know how to stop it, or they can't stop it for economic reasons, and yet it plays badly in terms of domestic politics. So is that a fair upsum of, and then the messaging through the media, social or mainstream, plays on that at scale? But is this a key linking dynamic? It's a dynamic. Sarah?
Just one note on that it's, we've focused on the sort of being against things. I think there's also certainly on the far right in Europe a kind of hopeful message, if you you may or may not buy into it. But the sort of, the kind of, whether it's make America great again or make France great again, or whether it was take back control here in Britain, our own version of it, it is a sort of, we can be great, and we can be, and for individuals feeling it, there's a kind of empowerment message. Perhaps it does come at the back of finding a kind of scapegoat and blaming us, but it's not just that.
Yeah.
It's not just against, it's also a pride and a sort of reinvigoration of a pride in, the nation or a particular group. And I think it's that combination that's probably quite appealing to some voters. I think if it was just being negative, it might not be as successful.
Which is one of the dangers for Joe Biden, because in many ways his campaign is based on fear. That guy out there wants to make this country an authoritarian, he wants to be a dictator. Whereas Trump is once again saying, no, we need to lift ourselves up, we need to make America great again, or Modi says we want to make India the leader of the global south, and so on.
No,
so,
the globe.
Well, the globe. Well, we know he's deluded about that, but he may have a case about the global south. But I think for Biden, for example, that's a danger. And sorry, to your point, I think, when people's basic standard of living is under threat, their kid can't get a job, their kid can't buy a house, they can't move house, when all of these basic things are a problem, they haven't got the bandwidth for the big issues, foreign policy, war, climate change. And immigration then does play a part, because they blame that guy, the Polish plumber. That's why my kid can't get a job, because of a Polish plumber, or whoever it happens to be. So there is something in there.
I don't want to come to Mukulike, but before I get there, just going back to the optimistic, I mean, you haven't mentioned Giorgia Meloni yet, and her particular brand of sort of relatively far right, but still with the toe in the centre, and certainly when it comes to NATO and Ukraine, quite a long way away from the French far right. I mean, is her position freestandingly interesting?
She's a very interesting far right politician in a sense. I think there was some nervousness about her coming in to becoming the Prime Minister of Italy in Brussels and the capitals around Europe. And I think now, of course, she's seen as quite a good partner to work with for other Europe. And that's partly because where she's moderated the most is on her sort of very pro-Western, pro-Atlanticist, pro-EU, not in the sense that, she's a sort of federalist, but in a sense I think she's figured out that she can work within the EU to maybe... So she's taken a very clear anti-Putin stance, which is in line with the European consensus. But also, even on immigration, rather than sort of saying, we need another referendum and get out of this, she's sort of said, no, we need her borders. Italy, of course, is one of the countries sort of directly facing the inflow of migration. So they're saying, no, we want to work within the EU to try and create a kind of fortress Europe, rather than just sort of trying to be on the outside.
Yeah. Okay. Mukulike.
No. India has a very important lesson for our discussions on democracy. India is called the Democratic Republic of India. And we talk about the democratic almost all the time in exclusion to the republic. And the word republic is actually quite important in the description of India, and none other than LSE's finest alumnus was responsible for it, B.R. Ambedkar, who did his PhD here, having done his PhD at Columbia, belonged to an ex-untouchable caste. I mean, this is as socially disadvantaged as you can get. And this is the person who's then chair of the drafting committee of the Indian Constitution, right? So we had a strong LSE connection there we should be all very proud of. Now, the insistence on the word republic was precisely, I think, to raise, as he put it, not just the fact that we are going to be a political democracy in India, he said, but we should also think about economic democracy and social democracy. And the word fraternity, which is almost never discussed enough, is very important, and I think speaks to your question and what we are saying here about being about hate or anger or protest. That the articulation of what we actually like about a country has been almost entirely captured by the right. Right? So it is about Make America Great Again is a slogan that you're meant to be now suspicious of. And you think, well, why wouldn't you want to make your country great? Why is there not a progressive, liberal, left, whatever you want to call it, language for affect, for re-enchantment of loving your country without the shrill dog whistles of nationalist rhetoric? Right? And can you have an articulation? And I think this has been a complete failure. In Britain, we saw that during the referendum. There was almost no clear enough articulation that was also communicative about what was good about being in Europe. Why was the European project a good thing? Now, in this particular election in India, we did see this re-enchantment also because, very curiously, the word love or muhabbat suddenly was being made part of public discourse. It was brought out really by the principal opposition leader, Rahul Gandhi, who said, in a marketplace of hate, I want to open a shop of love. It sounds much better in Urdu. Nafrat ke bazaar mein muhabbat ki dukaan khulna chahta hu. Right? And so suddenly, if you are then confronted by majoritarian politics, that is anti-minorities, immigrants, Muslims, whatever your favored minority is to hate, then to be able to talk about love actually articulated in real politics what fraternity looks like. And I think that is something that is missing in our discussion of progressive attachments to democracy.
Okay, I'm going to open to the audience and those at home online in a moment. But one for you, Nick, just before we get off this opening salvo, I mean, we all, you know, there's lots of discussion in the media itself about fake news and fact-checking and, you know, all of this stuff. But it seems to me that one of the problems, and this is much discussed in terms of the UK election, though I doubt it's unique to the UK election at the moment, is that the leading politicians in the parties that are most likely to win, one or two of them, can't bring themselves to tell the truth about the public finances, the need for tax increases or spending cuts, whichever of them wins. So at some level, they're engaged in a version of obscuring the truth themselves.
Can't mention the word Brexit.
They can't mention the word Brexit. Another good one. Yes, so there's two things they can't mention. Good point. Is that right? It's not just the bad people doing bad things, it's, you know, the mainstream people as well.
No, I agree, and I think the incentive structures are set up in that way. So it was interesting reflecting on the referendum, right? So why was there no positive pro-EU message? It's because they focus grouped it and they found it didn't work. And certainly if you talk to the people who ran that campaign, what they will say is that they went with the message that was the best message they could possibly use in terms of getting their vote out. Now, of course...
Which was what? I can't even remember what
that was. The message was it would cost us a lot of money to leave.
Mm-hmm. That's very positive sentence.
And it did.
But it did. But it, so interestingly, though, they did do one poster, which was a slightly different one, and then they never really put it out. And if you speak to the people who ran Vote Leave, they will say this was the one they were terrified of, was there isn't a plan. And they never really went with that message, interestingly. Mm. They tried it, and then it kind of didn't go anywhere. So I think part of this is a process issue about how are political communications generated and what do people deem to work.
Yeah.
And of course, there are structures that are set up around that, for example, with 5 years parliament. Or, you know, I've just made a slightly snippy comment about Keir Starmer's debate performance. Or last time I checked, he's 25 points up in the poll. So, you know, by his metrics, it's going pretty well. So maybe a different way of thinking about it are the types of institutions that can then foster that sort of conversation and what kind of institutionalisation of democratic processes can lead to these more difficult conversations.
Be good. Okay, let's look around the audience for the first hand I see. There's lots of hands suddenly. So the first hand I saw was that guy there. So slightly random, not very democratic way of doing it. And then there's a hand here next. Yeah.
Hi, good evening. I'm Johnny, an LSE alumni. I'm struck by all of you, to some extent, by when you're talking about the respective countries, how distinct the different groups or different geographies there are within those countries. So we talked about the states, the western, the coastal states in the US compared to the hinterland. We talked about the rural population in India compared to the cities. We talked about the people who prefer populism versus technocrats in Europe. And it seems that the complex societies that we live in with this very fragmented sort of social structure means that democracy is incredibly hard to actually enact. And I wonder if you think that's fair, and if you think then what can be done by non-political civil society actors to try and support a kind of coherence around the different social or geographical groups that can contribute to democracy.
Just okay. One quick observation.
Take another question.
Go ahead.
Okay,
no.
I'm going to do two or three at a time for efficiency's sake. Yes,
go ahead. Hi, I'm Gibran. I'm LSE International Relations. And what my question was based around an interesting piece of data I saw recently about younger voters in the UK and Europe. So I saw that in Europe, younger voters are more likely to be, or increasingly likely, to be appealed by these far right or populist messages or anti-immigration messages, compared to in the UK, where younger voters continue to remain much more liberal. Even in America, I think that's the case. So I was wondering, according to particularly the European experts, why do you think this is the case, and what's causing these dividing lines in younger voters? Thank you.
Okay, and I'll come back to you, I promise, my friend. I can't even see you. Wave your hand very wide, though. Can you direct where I can't see here?
Pointing out the women in the audience.
Yeah,
you
no,
but
there,
again,
there,
you can't
there.
See her. Yeah,
I can.
We can't see you very clearly.
Yeah.
Thank
Sorry.
You. I was wondering, you called this message, this kind of Make America Great Again message, my name's Kai, I'm in the Media and Communications Department, so thinking about messaging and communications, this kind of hopeful message of Make America Great Again or Take Back Control, I see as being kind of a restorative message, that it's not just Make America Great, it's Make America Great Again or Take Back Control. And it seems to me that the kind of populist side is speaking to this feeling of loss, that something isn't as it should be or isn't as it was. And I'm just wondering if there are thoughts of, or if observations of any parties on the left side that are kind of speaking to that, I think, very real emotion in a non-restorative, non-populist way.
Okay, very good. Okay, and I'll come around for another round, I promise you, and I haven't forgotten you. Bill, you were on your way to answer a question.
I was just going to make a quick observation to your point that it's not just, you know, Europe and America where we see these strange common themes. I covered an election in Iran in 2009, and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad won it, and it was broadly derided in the West as a fix, that it was corrupt. He won in the rural areas, he lost in the cities. So Tehran, for example, where he used to be the mayor, he didn't win. basically all the major cities he lost. So there is this divide even in a place like Iran between rural and urban, between the less educated and the more educated, although that wasn't really the case in India, between the young and the old. It's actually quite a common theme these days.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
You were asking about young voters and the contrast. Actually here in the UK, and Nick will know, is the age sort of divide is perhaps the starkest. It's less stark, even though it's more is being made of it on the continent. I mean, it's so stark that all of you under whatever 46 are when the dividing line is, when you can sort of possibly start thinking about voting Tory. You should all be voting Labour. I mean, I don't want to sort of, just this is just my sort of statistical model. And in particular also, which is another divide, of course, is you're living in a city, many of you, so then you're also definitely Labour. And then on top of that, you're all highly educated. So this is, so these are the sort of three things that are, three of the factors, and that's a change, like social class and income and these things are much less. So here we really see it. And part of that, I think, also is because what Labour is offering, or, you know, it's a sort of change, and often young people want change. And for some young people on the continent, Germany and France are two countries where we saw quite a few young people, according to the surveys that have come out, exit polls that have come out, voting for the radical right, although also older people. You know, they offer a message of change. You know, if you think things are not working for you, you think you're not going to, you know, be able to buy a house or get the same kind of job as your dad, you know, they're saying, you know, there's a... here is we offer you a chance or hope for something different. But that is compounded by these other things, you know, where you live. If you're highly educated, for example, you live in a city, that message is not as likely to appeal to you, and that's the same on continental Europe as it is here. Then you're more likely to think maybe the kind of change you want comes from, you know, a Green Party or something. So we see those same things in Europe.
I just wanted to take the question on emotion in politics, and that was the point I was trying to make, that we don't have a language of emotion on the non-right, however you want to define that. I mean, it's astonishing that the two best slogans, whether used or not, are about it's going to cost us a lot and there isn't a plan. That doesn't sound positive to me. Right?
That's not impressive. I mean, even with there's the no process.
So even now in this election in Britain, you know, I've been reading a lot of Labour Party history about this country, and you know, there's no articulation of what good things a Labour government has done and how transformative it is and why it is actually quite nice to live in a society where there is less inequality and there's some sense of justice and dignity for everyone, which is a nice positive thing. You've got to spin it and have a catchy slogan, but where is that language? And that language of emotion is entirely on the other side. That's exactly my point. I agree with you.
It's interesting, during the Scottish referendum back in 2014, all the technocratic stuff was being fired, and there's a lot of, obviously, from Scotland itself, a lot of slightly more emotional, cultural stuff. And the only people who, oddly enough, got this right, as far as I can see, in England were sort of actors and singers who had an event in Trafalgar Square to say they loved the Scots, which I thought actually was on this occasion nearer right than they normally are, but that's just a personal view. I'm not supposed to express these from the chest. Do you want to say something, Nick?
Just a couple of things. One point about the fragmentation. I think something that's going to be really interesting in this upcoming UK election is the extent to which, if at all, I think it probably will though, the political geography of Brexit unwinds and you start to see a more traditional voting election in terms of where people are voting, because it may be that the 2019 election was a very, very strange election in that it created what has now turned out to be quite an unstable alliance. I also just wanted to go to this point of restorative slogans, and I think this is really it's a really perceptive question, because I think clearly, obviously, it makes sense for the right to tap into ideas of nostalgia, or the past or a lost past. I mean, I might venture that sometimes some of those slogans, and I think you're exactly right to zone in on the again, because maybe that there is a, for example, a racialized dimension to that slogan and what it's actually doing. But there was, I'm going to do a really dangerous thing here where I'm going to cite a book I haven't read, where I've only read the review. My excuse is the book only came out a day ago. But it was in The Guardian this morning. They reviewed Torsten Bell's book, who's going to be a Labour MP for Swansea. He's a think tanker and he's just got a seat in Swansea. But the interesting thing that his... And he's the columnist. But the interesting thing that his book, according to this review at least, the key theme is, how do we get back to normal? And I think that's quite an interesting idea, that what people have lived through in the past 10 years in the UK, but in lots of places, would have been unimaginable previously, if you think about things like Brexit or lockdowns. And but then, of course, you get into the question, what does normal look like? I mean, what is the imagined moment in time you're going to rewind to? But I just thought that was quite an interesting way of constructing the question.
Okay, so I promised you a question, and I want to see if there are any online as well, Greg. So if you can bring a microphone down to the guy here. Thanks.
Hi, I feel like I've kind of missed the boat on my question, because my undergraduate thesis is about diaspora communities, and one thing that taught me is it was the first time I conceptualized the notion of imagination in politics, right? Like, diasporas are kind of formed on this idea of a community. And I think it speaks to a lot of the things that we're touching on here, the idea that, like, make America great again. Like, there's a historical thing we're yearning for. To take it that further, kind of misinformation and post-truth. Like, the idea that, like, we have to engage with something that we can't really make sense of. Do you know what I mean? And I think there's something that... I would just kind of just ask specifically you, I can't remember what your name is, sir, to speak to the idea of like imagination and having to deal with things that we can't really conceptualize and that we kind of just have to accept as feelings, do you know what I mean? Especially when that becomes, like, you know, when that turns into populism and things like that.
Mm-hmm. It's great. Okay. We're moving into, now I've got to come down to online here, sadly, we're going to have to finish at 7:45. Normally, I'm so attuned to things finishing at 8:00 that I feel it, but anyway, online.
So I've got two questions from A-level students, both of whom may be future LSE students. Number one, a question for all speakers. If we see a Trump presidency, how do we think his isolationism would affect Europe and institutions and groups such as NATO and the G7? And that comes from Jonathan. And then I've got another question from Marinella, who's also an A-level politics student from Portsmouth, who asks, does the rise of the far right and populism in Europe mean a decline in democracy?
Okay, well, great questions. Thank you online and in the room. Who'd like to have a go at those wide-ranging and intriguing questions?
Just a quick one on Trump. I mean, he is an existential threat to NATO. And Putin will be clinking champagne glasses in the Kremlin, as they did when he won the first time, and especially an existential threat to Article 5, which says, you know, an attack on one is an attack on all. Donald Trump doesn't care a damn about Estonia or Latvia. He certainly won't go to war for them. So to Jonathan's point, I think that's the main threat of his presidency. There are so many threats internally, but externally, I think Europe should be very, very worried.
But I think that the spillover of that is that therefore, because it means that US protection could be gone, Europe will then have to really reconfigure itself in terms of being a more serious defence.
Which it can.
Would it push Britain and Europe closer together? Given
yes,
that NATO
I mean,
still
it definitely would, because of course Britain is a very serious security actor, you know, and the biggest military together with France in Europe. But already now, of course, there have been very serious talks, also including in Germany, about more defence spending. And, I mean, the thing is, sometimes when you want to bring people together, and that goes a bit also to the question of imagination, having outsiders, an other that's clearly not with us, can sometimes strengthen the internal cohesion. And I think having Putin on one side and Trump on the other side, I think, might sort of sharpen minds a bit in Europe about, you know, who are the friends. And so I think it will push Europe further towards more integration. Well, might not be enough to defend but in military terms, but in political terms, I think that's it. And just quickly on a democracy point, I think it depends a bit on what we think. Does it threaten democracy? Certainly, it's a threat to the kind of liberal democracy that we've come to know. And we see that, of course, in Hungary already, but it's a conception of democracy that treasures sort of rule of law, balance of powers, not the sort of, oh, we're going to cancel all elections tomorrow and there's going to be a sort of coup. That's not the kind of threat. But the decline of some of these institutions, and some of these institutions, for example, that protect minorities, those are the institutions and impartial courts and so on that are often under threat when you have populists in power.
So democracy can survive, or a form of democracy can live on, even if the institutions that are normally associated with a functioning democracy wither. That's the point.
I wanted to tackle a couple of those. First, the one about imagination. I think this is such a great question. And because, so one of the interesting responses we've had to fake news is doubling down on fact checking. So you will have seen these, right? Fact checking websites. And the empirical evidence basically is they're not very good, right? They don't really work. And the reason is people don't believe fake news, often because they actually believe the story. They believe it because it resides within a political imagination space about how they see the world and their experiences within the world. And so this is sort of a vox pop interview, but it's one that sort of quite often crops up in lectures on fake news, where they're interviewing Trump supporters and then they're told that these stories aren't true, and they say, well, it feels like it could be true. And that's kind of a good enough response. So I think this is really, really difficult question. I suppose that the point I was making is, well, what would an imagined version of democracy that can be articulated and is attractive actually look like? And I think that's an open question. I wanted to just deal with the last question as well a little bit. And good luck with your A-levels, if you're sitting them. But I think this point about the far right and democracy is really good. But I'd like to... I actually already alluded to him once already, but I'm going to mention Francis Fukuyama, because Fukuyama defines what's going on as a crisis in the liberal part of liberal democracy. And I don't know if I quite actually agree with your summation, Tony, because yeah, I think you probably learnt in your A-level seminars that, of course, these are two slightly incompatible ideas, right? Liberalism and democracy. But the counterpoint is, of course, if you lose that liberal dimension, very quickly you end up losing the democratic dimension. So all of these things like electoral commissions and constitutional court ultimately are the guardrails. And if you have a populist strong person who has removed those liberal institutions, they're going to be a lot harder to remove democratically. And there are obviously examples of some things where that might be happening in India, but obviously we can look at places like Central Europe where that is a lot harder than it would have been.
Mikulik.
I just wanted to say, since we have to wrap up, that so much of our discussion has been Euro-America, that the big elections that have already happened, and we've learned about the re-enchantment of democracy in these national contexts, Taiwan, Indonesia, South Africa, India, these have happened, these are to come. So there is a re-enchantment, it seems, or certainly a reassertion of democratic practices and culture in these national contexts. But in the international context, the way a possible return of Trump or the far right in Europe, it's really important to say that from the global south, the skepticism at the moment with what is happening in Gaza has really altered perceptions of democratic politics and the kind of leadership it throws up, where really the difference between opposing political parties look very blurred to a lot of people in this world at the moment. So we can't talk about global elections today without saying there is a huge disconnect in the international order of between democracies, or which ones count more than others.
Okay, now I apologize to everybody in the audience. I'm so sorry, you've had your hand up patiently. I really am. I'll get in terrible trouble if I overrun, so it's my fault. I'm sorry about that. All I can say is to you and to everybody else, come to more LSE festival events. Better chair than me will allow you to ask questions. That is my excellent panel, who've been brilliant, in my view. It's been great fun. And before we finish, I don't think I'm supposed to say anything else, looking at those in charge. One thing I would say, it's very easy. We talk about democracy. We're talking about the bad, almost always about the bad side of it, you know, the need for a bit more optimism, how awful everything is and all of that. All I'd say is this, for those of you who have never seen it, just over, I think it's over there in Sir John Soane's Museum, lies Hogarth's cartoons about elections in England in the 1780s. If you think anything's bad today, just see what Hogarth thought of that then. It's, some of it needs to be, you know, seriously, you have to have serious warnings before looking at some of what the iconography means. So it's not that bad. So again, thank you to my excellent panel. Come to more LSE Festival events. Lovely to see you all. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.